Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is the Compliance Guy.
The Compliance Guy.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is the Compliance Guy. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Happy Monday. Welcome to this special episode of The Compliance Guy. We didn't have a round table today, but I was able to wrangle one of the round table members, panelists, subject matter experts, friend, and convinced her to give up her Monday afternoon for a little while to hang out with me and talk about compliance. And she was more than happy to do it, it seemed like. And here we are. So I'm talking about Christine Hall with Sterling Global down in Florida. And Christine is a subject matter expert, knows a lot about a lot. And I always appreciate her insights and her approach to how she looks at things. Sometimes she doesn't get a word in or as many words in as she would like to on the Monday roundtable because there's so many interesting personalities. So today I'm going to kind of give her the floor because I think we have a really cool topic. And I think it's something that those who are in the world of compliance, in the world of audit, in the world of practice management operations, unfortunately find themselves staring down the barrel of this topic and thinking to themselves, what do I do now? Because the provider told me absolutely not. So Christine, I'm going to pause. I'm going to give you the floor and you kind of set the table, and where appropriate, I'll kind of fill in the gaps.
Well, thanks, Sean. So oftentimes we'll find ourselves either doing a proactive audit or even maybe a reactive audit. Say they got a TPE or they got something even worse that came in the mail that has to be addressed. And providers will bring it to their attention that a particular service hasn't been performed according to either the policy, the description of the CPT code, that basically they were overpaid for a service that they just didn't meet those requirements. And it could be something really simple like E&M visits that were coded higher than what was supported in documentation. Or it could be other services that have requirements that are really detailed in CPT and really detailed with the payer policies. And we've not made those. So I gave you a great example earlier. We were chatting about there's a group that was performing chronic care management, and they're just bringing in anybody, not a clinical person, to provide those 20 minutes per month of chronic care management services. Now, chronic care management can be really, really awesome. If you've got patients that are struggling with chronic conditions, diabetes, hypertension, and they just can't seem to get on top of it, having that person, you know, even as little as 20 minutes per month, who can kind of guide them or make sure they picked up their meds or make sure they got into the cardiologist to get the stress test done or whatever it was that they needed to assist them with for that condition to try to get it to a stable. That was the goal of chronic care management. No, this organization has just got anybody reviewing charts. One of the people that were working there, Sean, well, he was a previous car wash person. And they were like, hey, do you want to just come and do chronic care management instead of washing cars? And so her documentation said, reviewed patient's chart today. And I'm thinking, what did you learn in car wash school that qualifies you to review someone's chart for chronic care management?
Yeah, right. That's, you know, so it's concerning. And listen, I understand there's a shortage of individuals who are willing to work for whatever reason, and however they're surviving, I don't know. Because there's no shortage of jobs available for people, but what we're finding is a shortage of qualified individuals to be able to fill skilled labor jobs. You know, not only are we talking about something that's really stupid to do, right? Like bringing somebody who's never worked in healthcare before in to review medical records, you know, and to say reviewed patient medical charts for 20 minutes. But now we're talking about the potential for malpractice. We're also talking about the potential for the federal government to come after you for substandard care. People do not realize that under the False Claims Act, the Department of Justice is actually prosecuting individuals for substandard care because you are falsifying on a claim form that you actually provided the services as required by guideline, by statute, act, law, whatever it may be.
MassHealth is coming back right now. MassHealth is using that exact example, substandard care, to claw back funds that were paid during COVID. And I have mixed feelings on that. I think providers were doing the best they could, especially in those first few months of 2020. And for to say there were substandard care, well, we kind of knew going into this, and even the governor of Massachusetts had said then, we know things are going to look a little different, but we need to work and strive on getting that put back together. So yes and no, like I get it, but right now we do have particular payers that are looking at that from substandard care perspective, and they are recouping funds.
Absolutely. And, you know, I know some of our listeners are going to be thinking to themselves, well, you know, who are these individuals to make determinations as to whether or not something is substandard care? Well, they're not just looking at the medical record. They're making phone calls to the patients, and they're asking the patients, on March 18th, you saw Dr. Jones, and you saw him or her for the following reason. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me a little bit about what transpired during that visit? And the patient says, well, you know, I got there, they checked me in, I waited for 45 minutes, they took me back to the room, I waited another 20 minutes for the provider to come in, the doctor came in, asked a couple of questions, I asked a couple of questions, the doctor said, okay, here's a prescription, and sent me on my way, but I still had more questions, but they kind of ushered me out. And now all of a sudden, you know, the insurance company is like, well, we got billed a level 4 service for that. Where's the medical necessity? Or where's the time component? Because they're going to say to the patient, how long would you estimate you spent face-to-face with the provider? 2 minutes, maybe? Well, how do you justify a level 4?
I saw the letters that were sent to some of the patients asking those specific questions, where patients were documenting that and sending it back. Of what time they spent, what was the quality of the visit, what was the interaction, not just with the provider, but with the staff that was there. And they're also opining on their experiences with the payer, and the payer's using that as well.
That's right. You know, listen, documentation paints one part of a picture. It is a multitude of things. So I tell people all the time, you know, when I'm doing investigations on behalf of a composite medical board, I always start off by giving the provider the benefit of the doubt, because I always explain to people that there's multiple sides to a story, right? There's yours, there's mine, and somewhere in the middle lies the truth. And these things on either side of my head, I consider them to be human BS detectors, because I've been doing this for 30 years. So I always tell a provider at the beginning of the phone conversation, listen, I'm not here to judge you. I'm not here to figure out guilt or innocence or anything like that. I am strictly here on a fact-finding mission, and my job is to write an unbiased report and to make a determination as to whether or not you should be escalated to the full medical board for review. And it's up to them to make a determination as to whether or not you should be sanctioned or suspended or lose your license or fined. I have nothing to do with that. But I am the stopgap between you and potentially a nightmare. So let's have an open, honest dialogue. I'm going to ask you very straightforward questions. I just need your responses to those questions. I don't need a dialogue. I don't need a dissertation. I don't need you to explain to me how, you know, this, that, or the other thing works. I need to understand merely what transpired. I'm going to share with you what the allegations were or are from the individual who made the complaint. And I'm going to give you ample opportunity to give me your side of the story. And then anything that you have in the way of documentation to support your position, it's only going to help your argument.
Well, I'm not unsympathetic. I've talked to a lot of providers who truly didn't know. And I get that.
Absolutely.
But you have to make sure that you've got good people that are working for you. And when those good people come to you and say, hey, you're doing this incorrectly, that you take ownership of that. Because at the end of the day, that surprise of I didn't know, I mean, you're still responsible for some action.
That's the point. And claiming stupidity is not a justifiable defense. Ignorance, deliberate ignorance, is a prosecutable offense under the False Claims Act. Deliberate ignorance, reckless disregard, which is, you know, gross negligence.
Yeah.
Burying your head in the sand.
I'm not going to worry about it. Somebody else's problem.
Yeah. Well, somebody else's problem has now become your problem.
Exactly.
And that's why we encourage providers to not only surround yourself with quality, well-educated individuals, but when you hire these people, you have to allow them to continue their education. Because we work in an industry where things are changing on a daily basis.
And
it's a full-time job just to keep up with this stuff.
It's the only constant we have in this industry.
Yeah.
But Sean, I think the other thing that's important is providers have to remember that they have to be accountable. And that's where the compliance program comes in. And if nothing else, if you don't have time to attend your compliance meetings, check in with your compliance officer once a month. What was the highlights? Let me know what we're doing in our practice here. Let me know if there's anything that we need to change. Be part of the chair that education so that everybody gets the message and they do it right. I think that's one of the most important things. You want patients to trust you as a provider. Providers also have to make sure that they're doing everything they can, not just to protect that patient physically, but also financially, emotionally, economically. You know, we're moving into a new world where we take social determinants of health very seriously, but I don't think providers realize that that also includes making sure you're not overbilling your patients, overcharging your patients, because that becomes a stressor as well.
It does. You know, you and I were talking before we got started about, you know, my recent health plight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I'm not going to go in depth with this, but here's something that I will say. I have begun the process of looking for other health systems, other providers to gain a second opinion for what's going on. And, you know, I don't have an infected toenail. I mean, you know, we're talking about my heart, right? And I take this stuff very seriously, considering I have multiple stents already in my heart. And, you know, I take, you know, a lot of different medications. So one of the things that I started doing in trying to make a determination as to, do I go to Piedmont Health System? Do I go to Wellstar? Do I go to Emory? Where do I go? Do I go to Atlanta? Do I go to Noonan? Do I go to Peachtree City? Do I go to Columbus? Do I stay in LaGrange? Mm-hmm. So what I've done, and you know, this is why my wife says I'm absolutely insane. I will go and I will read the reviews, but I don't read just a few. I will read all of the reviews that are on there, because some people just love to complain, right? And they'll say, oh, I had to wait 3 hours. Okay, well, it's an emergency room, okay?
Yeah.
It's a level one or level two trauma center. You know, you went there and you said you had chest pain, but it wasn't in an area where somebody would have an, you know, alarm for, you know, a heart attack. And, you know, you said that they took you for an EKG when you got there, and then they started an IV and they drew blood. Well, guess what? If you go in complaining of chest pains, they're probably pulling a troponin to figure out where your numbers are at, to see if there's any ischemic, you know, activity, or to see, you know, what's going on. And if the troponin comes back that, you know, you're, and they're all using these high sensitivity troponins these days. And if your troponins come back in normal range, you know, if your chest pain's been less than 2 hours, then, you know, they're going to do a one. If it's been 6 hours or greater, you know, they're going to, you know, pull multiple troponins. And if it increases, then maybe there's a problem. If it decreases or stays the same, there's no problem. And, you know, if the EKG shows normal sinus rhythm, you're not having a heart attack. You know, if it says you're in VTAC or you're something else, sure, guess what? They're going to look at that and they're going to get you back immediately. And hopefully they're going to go through the heart attack protocol. Give you, you know, the four baby aspirin, get you started on, you know, heparin, get you started on nitroglycerin, give you morphine, whatever it is. So, but for me, I go through and I look at like pictures people post of how clean a facility is or how dirty a facility is. I gauge what they say about the interaction of the nursing staff. The interaction of the providers.
Do you ever go and look to see if they're on a CIA? Do you look for the DOJ hot sheets like Betty Hovey posts?
Yes, I do.
I do the same thing. I go to look because I know we know enough to know. I not only do I want to know that I'm going to get good care in the emergent times, but I want to see, am I also going to get good care later on? I have another great example. I have another provider's office that I had gone as a cash patient for 2 years and finally needed to use my insurance for a service that they had. Now, in those 2 years, I built a great relationship with the practice. I knew the practice owner. I knew the practicing providers in the practice. They knew what I did for a living, even as far as took my advice and hired a compliance officer to come in and do an assessment and put a program together. I didn't want to do that because I liked these people. I didn't want to be part of that. I want to be the patient there. Sure. And the first time I needed to use insurance, sure enough, it was an epic failure. And very sad, right? But I look at all kinds of things, Sean. I look at not only the Yelp reviews, which I think are important, but I also look behind the curtain as well to see how have they been doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I do extensive research to determine what state agencies, what federal agencies, what settlement agreements have they entered into? Why did they enter into? Listen, every hospital is going to get tagged for something. Mm-hmm. I spent the first 20 of my 30 years working in major health systems, okay? And when you have thousands of employees, right? Tens of thousands of employees.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, no matter how good your compliance program is, something's going to happen. And it's going to cause heartburn and indigestion, and you have to figure it out. Now, I know enough after 30 years to be able to say, that's not really a system-wide problem. It was contained to one specific entity within the health system. You know, it was probably cheaper for them to settle than fight it. Right. What's your corrective action plan? What's the CIA, et cetera, et cetera. And then I make my determination. But you know, there's something else that I think about, and you brought that to light today when I said, hey, you want to jump on and do a podcast? You said, my topic that I'd like to talk about is when providers receive either monies they're not entitled to, or they've been overpaid for something beyond what their documentation supports, they have a obligation to refund the money, but they don't and they won't. So let's kind of pivot and let's talk about that.
Christine, I'm not in a position to do that right now. Oh, really? I wonder if we tell the power company. I'm just not in a position to pay that right now. Will they still let us get away with power, incur more bills, incur more errors?
Well, it's like going to the food store, walking up and down each aisle with your shopping cart and putting only the foods that you need to survive into the basket, right? So we're not putting Ho-Hos or Twinkies or, you know, Mr. Pibb Extremes into the shopping cart, right? Because they're not part of the seven basic food groups. Now, they may be part of my food groups, but not the basic food groups. And, you know, as you're walking towards the cash register, you just walk past the cashier and you go, thanks. See you next week. Send me a bill. It doesn't work that way. They're going to chase you into the parking lot and some burly security guard is going to say, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't work that way when a provider has received money that he or she is not entitled to, especially if we're talking about federal payer funds.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It doesn't make any sense to me that we would not immediately take action when we realize that we've received monies that we're not entitled to.
You know, Go ahead.
Well, you know, and another thing that I hear from providers is, well, they paid me, so it must be okay. And I have to really break it down to them and explain. First of all they know is what you told them. On a claim form, you said the patient had hypertension and diabetes, and I saw them for a level 4 visit today. That's all that they see on your claim form. Why would they not assume that the documentation supported that? Or you said that you provided chronic care management for 20 minutes this month. Why would a payer think that that's not true? They take you at face value. And once something has been brought to your attention, and hopefully it's proactively, hopefully it's doctors management who's doing a proactive audit, or it's Sterling Global who's doing a proactive audit. And we say, listen, this was done incorrectly. We can do education and moving forward, we'll do it correctly. But in the past, now you've got monies that you're not entitled to. And it floors me, Sean, when I have providers that are like, well, listen, if they don't ask for the money back, I'm just not giving it to them.
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
And you're leading us to a great intersection, which is the Accountable Care Act, right?
Mm-hmm.
So under the ACA, Section 6402B specifically addresses that providers have a obligation to return monies voluntarily within to the federal payer program within 60 days. Now, a lot of people get confused on the 60-day rule because they're like, oh my God, I only have 60 days to refund the money. No, you have 60 days after identification and confirmation of an overpayment. So you really have 6 months is what the government gives you to conduct a bona fide investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And upon conclusion of that investigation, if it is determined that you have an overpayment, you have 60 days from that date in which to issue that money or that refund back to the payer. And failure to do so could lead to a reverse false claim.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are like, well, wait a minute, what's a reverse false claim? A reverse false claim is where the government actually looks at your intent at the time you filed the claim to receive that remuneration. So, you know, the point is very simple. One, you got to have a compliance program. Two, that compliance program has to be a living, breathing document.
Mm-hmm.
In order to be a living, breathing document, that means you have to have policies and procedures that are updated on a pretty regular basis. And I would say at a minimum once a year, somebody needs to be looking at your compliance program and saying, that's still applicable. That's no longer applicable. This was good last year, but we have to update it to this for this year. That's how you demonstrate a good faith effort to the government. Excuse me. That is how you demonstrate a culture of compliance within an organization. Go ahead. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I remind people I kind of look at compliance a little differently. We've all participated in compliance our entire lives. It may have looked a little different. When my kids were growing up, we had a compliance program in our home. Most homes do, like it or not. We had a policy. You got to keep your room clean. That's the policy. I sat down with each kid. We went through the procedure of how to clean their room. What was the right way? Don't shove it under the bed. Don't shove it in the drawers in the closet, right? We did education. I took feedback from them. We had open lines of communication because their siblings would tattletale on them. So-and-so put it under the bed, right? Then we had to do investigations. When that was brought to our attention, did they really do it or did they didn't do it? We audited, we monitored it. And God forbid my mother-in-law came in behind me because, you know, she was going to find things that I didn't.
Of course.
And then there were consequences that were put in place.
Disciplinary action.
Absolutely. And I could go on. I mean, driving, when you learn to drive, there's laws that you've got to follow. You can't tell the police officer, I didn't know how fast I was going, officer. He doesn't care. I really don't want that ticket. He doesn't care.
Yeah, I really don't want it. Can we start over?
Yeah, I don't think I should have to pay that. Really, I'm a nice person. I'm doing good work here. I'm trying to get to work.
Yeah.
That doesn't work. No. So why would our compliance in our organizations be any different? Why wouldn't we want to know that we're doing a good job and that we're doing it according to the standards that we put in place in our organization? You know, you can hope that that's happening, but how do you know that's happening?
Well, so, the only way to know whether or not your compliance program is effective is through continuous auditing and monitoring of the compliance program. You know, and again, we have to audit, we have to monitor, we have to, you know, figure out where the gaps are. We have to close those gaps. And when there's a problem, we have to fix the problem. Not kick the can down the road.
They had a checkout person who had been stealing money for 7 years. How can you let someone go 7 years? Was there absolutely no policy and procedure in place? No checks.
Well, they were really good at their job.
They came in on time every day. They, right?
They Blows never took a mind. Lunch break.
Obviously.
You know, I know we're laughing about these couple of little things here, you know, because, you know, we're trying to, you know, keep things a little bit on the light side for, you know, some of the things we're talking about. But at the end of the day, compliance is serious. It should not be a punchline. It needs to be the tagline of your organization. And ignoring the obvious, kicking something under the bed, thinking that you can hide it, or just ignoring it and wishing it away, is not how things are supposed to be done, and they're not how things are going to be done in the eyes of the Office of Inspector General, the Special Investigative Units of an insurance company, or the Department of Justice.
And it's not immediate, Sean. It's like that thing under the bed. It festers, it foams, it stinks. And later on, three months later, 6 months later, 3 years later, eventually it grabs somebody's attention.
That's right.
And I think that's important for us to remember is most of the time when you and I come into a situation, this isn't something that happened last month. This is something that happened 3-4 years ago and now has snowballed so large that, you know, it's going to affect the practice. It's going to affect everyone from the provider majorly. It's going to affect the staff when you come to work with a padlock on the door, or it's going to affect the patients when they need you and they can't reach their providers or they have to start all over again with somebody else. And again, it's not today, but when it happens, it's going to hurt.
Yeah. So I'll share a very quick story with you. I'm terrible with timing. It was right before the beginning of COVID. So I'm thinking this was 2019. Memory serves correct. I got a phone call from then a client of mine. And he's whispering. And it was like 7:30 in the morning.
That's not a good sign.
And he goes, Sean. I said, yeah. He goes, it's Dr. Smith. I'm just going to say Smith. And I said, hey, doc, what's going on? He said, listen, I am sitting at a coffee shop across the street from my office. And there's a bunch of Grand Marquis and some unmarked Chevy Impalas. And there's some guys and ladies walking around with DEA, FBI, OIG coats. And I said, okay. I said, remind me, how many total providers are there in your group? And he said, oh, it's just me and two nurse practitioners. I said, okay. He said, what should I do? I said, what do you mean, what should you do? I said, don't you want to know what's going on? He said,
go across the street.
Yeah. He said, no, I kind of already know what's going on. I said, okay. I said, well, I can't give you any legal advice, but if I were in your situation, and apparently you know what the problem is, you need to call your attorney right now, go to his or her office, and negotiate a surrender for you to be interviewed by whichever agency's leading this investigation. Mm-hmm. He literally said to me, I can't make this stuff up. What's my other option? I said, what do you mean? He goes, seriously. I said, you don't have another option other than go home, unload all the money and stuff that you have in your safe, grab a passport and a bag and run. I mean, but that's not the answer. And he said,
are you sure?
I'll call you. And I did not hear from him again. And they wound up, I think, actually one of the agents saw his car and they surrounded him before he could get out of the parking lot. They took him into custody right then and there. And I'm not going to really go through it because people could figure out who he is by, you know, typing in, you know, some of these details. So I'm just going to leave it at that. But, you know, folks, Christine's right. The OIG and FBI don't just show up after like 2-3 months of something going on because they have lots of fish in their pond that they are looking at. They come after years of data mining, years of monitoring, audits. You know, people don't understand that a unified program integrity contractor may have, and I have this all the time. I just had a situation like this about 2 months ago where a provider said to me, hey, you know, a UPIC did an investigation on us, you know, an audit like 3 years ago or 2 years ago, whatever it was. And we've never heard any results from them. Well, that's probably because the Office of Inspector General had a do not escalate on there because OIG decided to engage and take a closer look. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I also, you just sparked my memory. I had a provider who said, Christine, we had an audit and we passed with flying colors.
Oh, I hear that all the time.
Yeah. Who did your audit? PsyOps. PsyOps is, they're just gathering data for HEDIS measures, for performance measures, for other things. They're not there to audit you and your services and your documentation for reimbursement perspectives. You need to know who these agencies are who are reviewing for you and understand what they're doing. What are they looking at? And especially with HIPAA, you should know who's coming in your office and pulling records and why are they pulling records? They should have given you a letter that explained that.
That's right. You know, our very good friend, Terry Fletcher, always likes to say to people, you know, people have to call Sean when, you know, the poop hits the fan. Mm-hmm. And then it's kind of too late, you know. It's not really too late, but it's probably not the ideal time, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I try to explain to Terry all the time, I don't want people to call me after they've already created a problem. I want people to call me before they do something stupid. I want people to reach out to me like they do others to say, hey, we're thinking about doing X, Y, and Z. Do you see any problems with that? And, you know, allow me an opportunity to engage proactively to say, hey.
But Sean, everybody else is billing for it and they're making a mint off of it. Why can't I do it?
Listen, amniotic fluid for musculoskeletal. I cannot tell you how many of my providers, okay, my orthopedic clinics were calling me and they're like, Sean, why are we not billing for this stuff? My friends are making $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a patient. I said, because it's bad news. Listen to me. The bottom is going to fall out on this thing, and you're going to be very glad that we didn't touch it. Sure enough, I had one client that said, you know, now the administration was absolutely with me, but there were two physicians who decided they're going to do it their way, like Frank Sinatra. And they went out and they performed hundreds of these things to the tune of over $300,000 that all of the providers in the organization wound up having to contribute to refunding the government.
That's a great point, Sean. I have had an overpayment to a group organization, and this overpayment could be from 3, 4, 5 years ago. And those providers don't even work there anymore. But now the new providers are responsible for that. That goes back to how you design your contracts. I think one of the most missed opportunities in healthcare is having a good healthcare attorney that you defer these types of questions that of contract, of liability, of
performance and behavior.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, listen, you know, I think providers, office administrators, compliance professionals who are listening to this podcast today, hopefully we've given you some insight into the things that you need to be paying attention to. Christine and I are always available. We're always happy to engage in some type of discovery conversation to see if and how we're able to assist you with whatever it is that you have going on. And listen, more often than not, you all know what you're doing. You just need affirmation. You just need somebody to come behind you and say, hey, listen, here's the citations to this. Here's the black and white to support your position. You are correct. But there are times where I have individuals who will interpret something and I look at it and I go, that's absolutely not what it says. I understand what you want it to say and I understand why you want it to say that, but that is not what it says. And let me help you to understand why it doesn't say what you want it to say.
We talked last week a little bit, or was it the week before, about incident two. And I had that same thing where I had a practice come to me and say, but look at the statute. It says by licensure, the physician can supervise the nurse practitioner. And I said, that's great. And you're right. But where does that say anything about billing for their services, getting paid for their services, your contracts with payers?
That's right.
Oh, again, sometimes you need that clarity to understand what you're looking at. And you can't cherry pick something and just pull out things that you want to manipulate to your advantage when really the it's very clear what you can and can't do.
And finding something in an obscure passage in a Medicare Learning Network booklet that has no citations and doesn't point you to any code of federal regulations or any specific chapter of the Medicare Benefit Policy Manual or the Medicare Program Integrity Manual, I don't care if it says exactly what you want it to say. If it is not sourced and cited, it is a booklet. It is not a policy manual. It is not a program integrity manual. It is not a code of federal regulation or a United States code. So be careful. Even though it says Medicare Learning Network, it may not necessarily hold water. So be careful.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm going to give you a great example. If we look at chronic care management, there's a fantastic MLN, Medicare Learning Network booklet. And I love this booklet. It's written in easy to understand terms. Right. But when you look at the resources to it, the resource is the Federal Registry. It's the final rule where chronic care management came out, and then a subsequent final rule where they have outlined some additional details. And the reason being is most of chronic care management is actually listed out in your CPT that you're supposed to follow. There's, and that takes us back to HIPAA and the code set and, you know, all of that, but you're 1,000% right. Remember that a lot of the documents that we read, even though it may say CMS at the top of it, or it may say a wonderful attorney group on the top of it, some of that is resource. You need chapter and verse. You need to review that and understand all the logistics that go into it.
That's right. Excellent point. All right. I got one final question for you, my friend.
Okay.
How do I get to provide education on a cruise ship in the Caribbean?
Oh, I can make that happen. We host Coding in the Caribbean every year now.
Can you add a compliance section to that and call it Coding and Compliance in the Caribbean?
So we were moving in that direction. So for many, many years, it's been an established cruise. Kim Huey, Kim the Coder, she started this cruise about 17 years ago, and to really to bring some education and to encourage us to take time off as well. Because you're stuck on a cruise ship, friends. It's not like you can go to the conference for 2 or 3 days and then just pop off, right? You're on, right. And so there was a wonderful concept out there to kind of help us remind us what balance. Families come, wives, husbands, children, grandchildren come and enjoy this. And we get some education at the same time, which is wonderful. She always did it for coding. I'd like to wrap in a little bit of billing and a lot of compliance. Again, I don't believe in just a coder. I think all coders also have some integrity for reporting those codes. And we're moving in that direction, Sean. So for sure, I think I'll have Lexi reach out to you maybe after this podcast and give you the 411.
Well, I know somebody called the compliance guy who would probably be a good fit.
Absolutely.
All right. So that's going to wrap up this episode of The Compliance Guy. I want to thank my very good friend, Christine Hall, for taking time out of her very busy schedule, as always, and spending some time with me, getting an opportunity to talk about compliance, obviously one of my favorite topics. And since we brought up the coding in the Caribbean, y'all need to get onto a website. Christine, do you have a place where they can go to see this?
They can go right to our company website, Sterling Global Solutions, and Sterling with an I, S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G, globalsolutions.com, and look for our Coding in the Caribbean cruise. There's a tab there, and you can find all the information you need to book your room. We're running out of rooms. I will tell you right now, the 25 cruise is filling up very, very quickly. Limited space available for that. We may even have to open up another batch of rooms. So reach out to us today and we'll be happy to have you come aboard. Well,
I'll be waiting for my invite. All right. And to each and every single one of y'all, thank you so much for tuning in, logging on and hanging out with Christine and I for a little while today as we got an opportunity to explore a few different areas of regulatory compliance and some coding stuff as well. I'll be back later this week with a daily dose. One of the first ones in a very long time, and I'm going to be taking on critical care services. Ooh. So I look forward to hearing some feedback from y'all. And as always, until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
Bye. Thanks, Sean.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. and we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media @The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.